Studios will premiere at the Kingston Canadian Film Festival. If interested, please visit kingston.ca/music to learn more.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, you also earn a ticket for one of our weekly raffle draws featuring prizes from local businesses including Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Smokes Poutinerie, Studio 330, Tango Nuevo, Terra Natural Foods, The Toucan, The Wit, and YGK Thrift. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.
And you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And it is just about to reach 1 minute after 5 o'clock, so we are officially now into the second hour of the show today, so thank you for having tuned in, hopefully, to the first hour as well. If you didn't catch it, one of the end-of-the-hour announcements that I always make is that both hours of my show each week are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Will remain there for 3 years. I usually get those uploaded shortly after I get home, so usually by 7 o'clock. If there aren't any glitches, they should be up and running there. So if you missed anything or missed the first hour and want to catch that, you can. And because I'm also, as mentioned in one of the promotions I just aired, is that our funding drive began November 1st and runs through December 31st. I just want to plug it briefly right now before we move into another book launch event. I just want to say CFRC is really pretty lucky to have the support of Queen students, and they provide us with some of our operating revenues. We do still sort of chug along on a shoestring budget, though, and radio equipment is pretty expensive, and costs keep going up, just like you know. And so we do appreciate everybody who has donated to date, so our heartfelt thanks to them for that. We also need support to community support to help us ensure healthy equipment and a healthy, tomorrow, for CFRC. If you are able, and any little bit helps, but you can find all the information you need at www.cfrc.ca. You'll see when the page opens up, you'll see a number of buttons at the top of the page. If you just click on the donate button, it will open up and to several pages of information about the funding drive. So if you want a tax receipt, you just go to the Give to Queens side of it and you will get a tax receipt. Or if you want to donate also securely through our website and get amazing free CFRC gifts and chances to win raffle prizes from local businesses. You did hear some of the sponsors earlier. For every $5 donated, you get one raffle ticket. And there's, depending on your level of donations, you'll see you get lots of gifts as well. So I'd encourage you to check out that site. And if you can, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And thank you now for tuning in or sticking around for the second hour for another book launch. Just a quick mention that every week, both hours are uploaded to my, I was looking at something else. Just the usual start, I should go back to that. The usual start of the hour announcement is that occasionally, some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. That's what I was starting to say. And I looked down at the page and I was looking at something else. And I pretty soon, the next thing I knew, I was reading that. So anyway, my apologies. Let's just go ahead and do this since I'm stumbling around here in this second hour. From an October 17th launch event at Novel Idea Bookstore, you're going to hear Arthur W. Gulakson launching his latest book, The Defeat and Attrition of the 12th SS Panzer Division, Hitler Jugend. This is Volume 1, The Normandy Bridgehead Battles, 7 through 11, June 1944. Let's just go ahead and move into that right now. Here we go.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much for coming today to see me give my presentation on Defeat and Attrition of the 12th SS Panzer Division Hitlerjugend, Volume 1, the Normandy Bridgehead Battle, 7th to 11th of June, 1944. First of all, I'd just like to thank Oscar and his daughter Nicola and all the staff of Novel Idea here. They're very, very good to me. They always allow me to put on these great book launches, and it's excellent. So, first of all, what was my reason for writing this book? As a teenager, I was fascinated by the Second World War German armored or panzer divisions. These organizations were close to 20,000 men strong in some cases, and the cutting edge of a military machine that conquered continental Europe, large swaths of North Africa, and all of the Ukraine and White Russia. I wanted to know what battles they fought, who their generals were, and what equipment they possessed. I was mainly interested, like many World War II nerds, in German tanks. I knew the Nazi regime was evil, and the Third Reich was defeated by the war's end, but I only had a vague idea of what Hitler's Second Army, the Waffen, or Armed SS, was, this being the military arm of the Nazi Party in wartime Germany. And I was more fascinated in their military battles. I did know they had several panzer divisions that seemed quite powerful, and all were destroyed by war's end. It was only during my early university years that the extent of the war crimes and atrocities committed by both on Allied prisoners of war on both the Eastern and Western fronts and to civilians in all theaters of war became apparent to me. Is this a book about, to a large extent, war criminals and their military operations? Yes, this is the exact focus. Many people, and Amazon category designators, mistake this book for being exclusively Canadian Army military history. This is not what it is. Did members of this division commit terrible war crimes in Normandy and would go on to commit many more before the war's end? Yes. But this book is very much not a glorification of anything they did or who they were, but a tool to accurately describe them in a historical setting and highlight their military and criminal actions as members of the military arm of a genocidal regime. These Waffen-SS soldiers were very much favored in the military pantheon that was the Nazi military state. Each one was very committed to the Führer, Adolf Hitler, and to Grossdeutschland, Greater Germany, and were seen very much as the planned saviors of the Reich, or Empire, German Empire. Committed German youth, mated with veteran Eastern Front officers and senior NCOs to organize and lead them, would hopefully turn the tide of the war, or at least stave off defeat that was very much looming for Germany in the year 1944. Thus, in 1943, one year earlier and after the Stalingrad disaster, an armored division was created and given the honorific title Hitler Youth. It was very much different from all the others. Each private infantry soldier in it was an ex-Hitler Youth member, born in the year 1926 and 18 years old or close to it by 1944. Each officer and the senior NCOs were Eastern Front veterans and highly combat experienced. It was given the best weapons Germany could produce for land warfare, these being the most advanced tanks, artillery pieces, mortars, and a lot of them. It fielded 20,000 men and was judged to be very well equipped, led, trained, and deemed ready for intense combat by June 1944. Placed in northern France, it was intended that this division would attack aggressively using armored maneuvers to encircle and annihilate the enemy, this being the Anglo-American armies that were expected to try and crack the concrete Atlantic Wall defenses of German-occupied France sometime in the coming spring. But before researching this subject for my master's degree in history thesis, which this book grew out of, I could not fathom why, with all their resources and perceived best leaders, the division and others like it could not and did not drive the Allied invasion forces back into the sea in the days that followed the 6th of June 1944 D-Day landings. This was the historical question I sought to definitively answer with this book, using this division as a carefully examined case study to explain why the Germans failed, and exactly how, often in minute detail, over the course of the five crucial days after the Allied invasion. But what would make this book new and different? There are swaths of books on the Hitlerjugend Panzer Division. One is produced roughly every 4 to 5 years. How can I make this one better or different than the rest? Luckily, I have to thank the Czech population in the immediate post-war period, in the former Nazi protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, in a castle. The Waffen-SS had their central archive. In this archive, all the war diaries of the combat divisions were stored. Despite fire and destruction that destroyed much of the contents of this archive, and the actions of the combat divisions in the field that destroyed much more at war's end, some material survived. And within the Czech military archives war trophy section are roughly 60% of the Normandy war diaries of the 12th SS Panzer Division. While some Hungarian and French military historians have used some of these resources, I'm the only one to make use of all of them in English for a 5-day period. This is what makes this book different and new. I cannot speak German fluently in a conversational setting, but I'm very good at translating typed documents. These war diaries and other research materials allowed me to make new and interesting observations on the period studied in the book, allowing new historical conclusions to be presented. Some of them are, well, first one deals with deployment and travel time to the front. The Hitlerjugend, in its original location in northern France, was well away from the beaches. It was simply too far from the front lines of the Normandy coast on D-Day. The delays in ordering it forward, due to the German high command thinking the Normandy landings were a diversion from the real invasion in the Pas-de-Calais across the Straits of Dover, wasted critical time. Then, simply moving the division was no easy task, as getting it to its destination involved its officers overcoming the handicap of it being misdirected in its first movements forward in its 150-kilometer journey. While this struggle to get ready and get 20,000 men, 192 tanks, and literally thousands of other vehicles moving occurred, the fighter planes of the Allied Air Forces pounced, inhibiting and slowing movement. In this way, the entire day of the 6th of June was lost, and major combat for only half the division occurred on 7th of June. Most critically, the Panther tanks, the absolute cutting edge of the divisional tank regiment, never arrived until the afternoon of the 8th of June. Thus, rather than attacking en masse with all its forces on a small portion of the front line, the division was overextended due to the complete collapse of the German Atlantic Wall static defenses and could only attack with part of its units rather than all of them. And this time, the Allies fortified their positions. This was critical in the eventual failure of this division to drive the Anglo-Canadian invasion forces back into the sea on the eastern side of the bridgehead. Communications, effective planning, coordination, and massing enough military force to accomplish a mission were all tremendous obstacles for the key leaders within the Hitlerjugend's regiments and battalions. The impact of radio triangulation and resulting Allied artillery fire and airstrikes simply inhibited the Germans from using communication devices such as radios regularly if they're in a static location. This had a huge effect on speed and effectiveness of command and control if you could only use runners and telephone landlines that were often cut. Also, a constant underestimation of the Anglo-Canadian forces allowed weak German forces to attempt to defeat stronger Canadian forces, as an example. This inability to coordinate, communicate, and mass combat power hurt the division's ability to conduct successful operations. Artillery. The use of artillery on the Eastern Front versus the Western Front was quite different. The Germans were very much shocked by the duration, coordination, and intensity of the fire of Anglo-Canadian artillery forces in the way of field, medium, anti-tank, and anti-aircraft artillery units of the Royal Canadian Artillery and Royal Artillery. This non-stop fire, mated with that of warships off the Channel coast, was simply overwhelming for them, and they could not mass the forces needed to overcome the Allied defenses supported by this monstrous combat power when they're trying to attack them. Holding the line and attacking at the same time. When the Hitlerjugend arrived at the city of Cannes, south of the Normandy coast, it found a gaping hole in the front line near the city. When a fighting unit is tasked to both hold the line, stopping the enemy from attacking or advancing, and with conducting its own attacks itself, it does neither well. This was a hard lesson for the German panzer or armored divisions that they learned in Normandy in June 1944, with the Atlantic Wall forces destroyed, captured, or dispersed. There's no cannon fodder forces that could hold the line while Hitlerjugend forces rested, trained, rehearsed, or gathered their strength in the way of tanks and other heavy weapons for their next operation or attack. The Hitlerjugend was doing both jobs, and its men quickly became exhausted, and its vehicle and weapon strength rapidly became depleted due to combat losses. Replacements. The Hitlerjugend received very little to no reinforcements in the way of people or equipment in June of 1944, and it is expected to fight with what it had to destruction. This inhibited an all-or-nothing drive of the division to attack to achieve its goals. Sooner or later, all parts of the division took on a defensive outlook, as the heavy losses they took in their first attacks were not replaced instantly. Fear of total annihilation took over, stopping an all-or-nothing attack to either win or be totally defeated, ignoring losses in the process. Leaders began to harbor their resources, fearing losses would cripple them and make them incapable of any sort of action. In time, in my book, I clearly identify something that is wrong with books in Normandy. Many identify the Germans as operating on a different clock, there being German time and Allied time separated by 1 hour. This is not the case, and only occurred in the early fall, on 17th of September to be exact, during the Allied Operation Market Garden, the airborne offensive into the Netherlands. As the Dutch military historians point out, the time in Normandy for both Axis and Allied armies was the same. War crimes and who committed them. Interestingly, many of the key officers on the ground during the war crimes that units of the Hitlerjugend committed were not Waffen-SS officers or senior NCOs. Due to the extreme shortage of qualified officers, many regular German army, or Das Heer, the army, officers, albeit with Hitler Youth backgrounds, were transferred to the division as infantry, artillery, and tank company commanders, making them key perpetrators as well as the Waffen-SS officers and NCOs in events post-battle which are horrific with regard to the murder of Allied prisoners of war. An example of the war crimes of the Hitlerjugend soldiers post-combat is one of my two short readings tonight from the book. To set the stage, during the first combat on the 7th of June, the twin villages of Athy and Biron near Caen have just fallen to the Waffen-SS, and the North Nova Scotia Highlanders and Sherbrooke Fusilier Regiments, tanks, have been driven back to Les Buissons to the north, leaving some wounded and stragglers behind to surrender. However, a summary of events is necessary, as it is important to illustrate for the reader the behavior of the SS Panzergrenadier, this is the infantry, in Athy-Biron and the surrounding fields. These events directly support the statement made by the author in the introduction to this work, that one of the important sub-factors that led to the defeat of the Hitlerjugend during this time period is that the Hitlerjugend officers and senior NCOs failed to exercise firm command and control during operations. Despite his long period of training, the Hitlerjugend recruits displayed a marked lack of observance of the Geneva Convention in their first operations. Lack of professionalism exhibited by the SS Panzergrenadier under the command of the battalion company Chefin, or battalion company commanders, manifested itself in outbursts of murderous rage that saw a multitude of war crimes committed on the evening of 7 June, once combat ended in Athy and Biron. This behavior illustrated the unvarnished true nature of murderous German National Socialism and the effects of propaganda the former Hitlerjugend had been subjected to since their early teenage years. This mentality had been reinforced by the approach to combat taken by the junior leaders who were present, which the young SS Panzergrenadier witnessed, emulated, and often exceeded. These veteran junior leaders who had survived 2 to 3 years of war by this point had been brutalized by the combat on the Eastern Front, which both sides displayed a complete lack of adherence to the Geneva Convention's rules on prisoner care. This statement is no way to excuse the offense in Athy and Biron, or to endorse the views of the Waffen-SS apologists. At academic conferences, the author has heard the story retold many times that a Canadian infantry platoon commander captured on the 7th of June had on his person company orders that stated no prisoners are to be taken, and this antagonized the Germans. There has never, to the author's knowledge, been any historical evidence to support this claim in the way of German or Canadian records or witness statements. Given the speed at which the prisoner of war killings began and the multitude of SS Panzergrenadier involved, it's highly unlikely any Canadian act or acts spurred them on to revenge. While the junior leadership of the SS Panzergrenadier company level was often a model of brutality, During the events of 7th of June, it was often the absence of leadership and supervision that arguably allowed some of the worst excesses. It's often overlooked by Anglophone historians that the 3rd Battalion of SS Panzergrenadier Regiment 25 had suffered heavy casualties in the Authien-Braun fighting. Many junior leaders whose presence influenced the level of discipline among the SS Panzergrenadier on the battlefield had been killed or wounded by Canadian defensive fire. The first crimes to occur happened in the immediate aftermath of the collapse of Canadian resistance in Authie. Wounded Canadian soldiers of the North Nova Scotia's C Company were shot or bayoneted in their orchard fighting positions where Captain Fraser of C Company and the A Company platoon had made their stand south of the village. These events were repeated in the positions of A Company north of the village. The village of Authie in June 1944 was laid out like many French farming villages with a mixture of stone-walled buildings, walled enclosures, often with orchards nearby, and the main road leading to other villages running right through the main square. The town square with its fountain was surrounded by stone buildings, and the D220 road runs right through the square, north to Braun and south to Frankville. On the western side of the square, there existed a line of trees next to a line of stone buildings. Across this intersection is the town church and graveyard. The scene inside Authie was anything but idyllic on the evening of 7th of June. Several buildings were on fire, and dead bodies from the combat that afternoon were strewn all over the streets. Emerging from the buildings were French civilians, men, women, and children, and the elderly who had not had a chance to escape in the hours earlier, and who thought the Canadians had liberated them from 4 years of German occupation and military rule. Within the square and on the exits to it, the uttermost brutality would be exhibited by the SS Panzergrenadier towards captured and wounded members of the Sherbrooke Fusiliers, the North Novas, the Cameron Highlanders, and French inhabitants of the village caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. Over a period of a couple of hours prior to sunset at 10 o'clock or 2200 hours, roughly 150 Canadian prisoners of war were rounded up from the fields and in the village. These prisoners were slowly pushed towards the town square. By last light, were gathered there together, assembled most likely by members of 9th Company or 15th Company of SS Panzergrenadier Regiment 25. It's unclear from the research of Howard Magrolian or archival material researched by the author where exactly the 9th Company commander or senior NCOs were during this phase and who exactly was running the show within the square. As the small groups entered the town square, a series of war crimes occurred, carrying on the pattern events that had begun at the end of combat. The most prominent event was the shooting of a group of 8 North Nova Scotia soldiers by a group of 3 SS Panzergrenadier who conferred about it first in an alley. The event witnessed by a wounded Canadian soldier slumped against the wall. One wounded Canadian soldier was killed by the Waffen-SS in a horribly casual manner, and his body was then dragged up the main road and through the square, where it was placed with the body of a second Canadian who had been killed, with the obvious expectation by the Germans that a wheeled or armored vehicle would crush the bodies. This occurred shortly afterwards as the 5th or 6th Company Panzer IV tank of SS Panzer Regiment 12 moving south from Baron crushed them, hideously mutilating the bodies under its tracks. The prisoners, mostly from the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, were told to stand in rows and orders were barked at them in German that must have sounded very sharp and curt to the Nova Scotians. The SS Panzer Grenadier moved from man to man, stripping everything from them except their woolen uniforms, belts, boots, and underclothing. The search was violent, and immediately the tone was set by the execution by pistol shot of one Canadian who, from eyewitness reports, moved his head around in a manner that the Waffen-SS felt was unacceptable. What exactly were the SS Panzergrenadiers so angry? Why exactly were the SS Panzergrenadiers so angry and brutal? One can only speculate, but it appears that most likely the reason for their brutality and hair-trigger conduct was because they were shocked at the losses incurred on them by artillery and tank fire in the combat south of the on the north side of Baron. Canadian historian Howard Margolian speculates that it was the twin factors of heavy losses incurred by the Waffen-SS combined by the prominent destruction of any sort of aura of invincibility or supremacy which drove the perpetrators to the war crimes to act as they did on the evening of the 7th of June, these men being primarily from the 9th and 11th companies of the 3rd Battalion of SS Panzer Regiment 25. My second reading tonight is from the conclusion and briefly sums up the main ideas presented in this book. Most importantly, why the offensive military operations of the Hitlerjugend did not succeed in the face of Canadian and British resistance. In conclusion, the Hitlerjugend had performed reasonably well tactically in combat on the 7th of June, But during the period 8 to 10 June, it suffered severe losses in return for non-existent territorial gains in its offensive operations. It could not mass its forces for a decisive thrust on a relatively short frontage, and like other panzer divisions, to arrive as part of the 1st SS Panzer Corps, was simply overwhelmed by Anglo-Canadian forces that slowly but surely defeated their battalion-level attacks and then forced them into a defensive role simply because no other unit was there to hold the line. Why were its battalions defeated in this time frame in battalion-on-battalion-level combat operations? Poor coordination, lack of overwhelming combat power available for the job at hand, and a complete shock at an entirely new enemy and style of warfare all contributed to the failures. Poor coordination was a factor that seemed to plague all Hitlerjugend operations from the 7th of June onwards. Effective formation-to-formation radio communications, most importantly for tank and artillery support, simply did not occur due to the threat of radio triangulation by enemy field artillery units and an arrogant, mistaken belief that what units were present would simply prevail over the Anglo-Canadian forces. All lessons learned from the North African-Italian campaigns against Commonwealth forces either had not been passed down or simply ignored by the Eastern Front Waffen-SS Kampfer, or our fighters, who waded into the fighting in small villages like Bretteville-Lorblouse in the same manner as they had attacked villages outside Kharkov in the winter of 1943. Enemy air attacks, radio triangulation, and lack of proper planning due to real or imagined time pressures all combined to equal repeated defeats, robbing the Hitlerjugend of the battlefield initiative. The rough and ready tactics on the unbroken Ukrainian steppe that worked so well against groups of huddled Red Army soldiers with a few T-34 tanks and one or two anti-tank guns now were completely ineffective due to the constant pressure from Anglo-Canadian field artillery, naval gunfire, and the never-ending strafing runs of the fighter bombers, the hated Yabos or Yab bombers, that inhibited daytime supply runs, road marches, and combat operations. Proper control at the Army Corps and division level was also a problem, as evidenced by the three Panzer Division Corps level attacks that simply could not get off the ground because of poor initial deployment too far from the beaches and their piecemeal commitment of forces that immediately became involved in combat or forced to simply hold ground. Lack of infantry to support armored attacks and vice versa was detrimental to the Hitlerjugend attacks on villages that caused unduly heavy tank and infantry losses. The battles with the 7th Canadian Infantry Brigade being especially costly. Aggression, certainly, was not lacking, nor was the desire to engage the enemy. Yet this could not make up for poor SS Panzer Grenadier, artillery, and panzer coordination. This coordination problem hampered the proper mustering of the requisite force necessary for operations. Major force was needed to overcome Allied fortress positions and their artillery-based doctrine. There were a total of four different Waffen-SS attacks on the twin village areas of Bretteville-Lorblouse, Norrie, and Bessin, none of which were successful. Despite many German units being in the area, including SS Panzer and self-propelled SS Panzer artillery units, the proper coordination to mass combat power of the sum of these forces did not occur. This was due to the Germans' overestimation of their capabilities and underestimation of the Canadian RCA, Royal Canadian Artillery firepower, and the infantry resilience of the Canadian Army. Canadians were also prepared for the German attacks and well trained by the British on the German doctrine. The severity of the Allied artillery fire shut down German operations totally and caused heavy Waffen-SS casualties. The coordination, speed, and intensity of massed RCA and Royal Artillery fire was far superior to that of the opposing SS gunners, despite their best efforts with what divisional ammunition assets were available. Piecemeal blitzkrieg tactics with light forces against this new enemy failed miserably, with commanders Meyer, Wunsch, and Monka all failing to make correct tactical battlefield decisions despite their experience. The fact that the Canadians were not the Soviet Red Army was one of the main factors involved in the failures. Hasty attacks with inferior forces had very little chance of success in the West. Quoting British military historian Michael Reynolds in his book on the 1st SS Panzer Corps in Normandy, Steel Inferno, the shock tactics, which had been so successful for the Germans in Russia, had failed miserably against the well-disciplined Canadian troops. Canadian Army official historian of the Second World War, C.P. Stacey, would go on to say, the German operations at this stage leave the impression of rather hasty and ineffective improvisations. The attacks were pressed with courage and determination, but no tactical skill. Interestingly, the entire General der Panzertruppen von Schweppenberg's notion and strategy of allowing the enemy to land and attacking him with a massive delayed panzer counterstroke was entirely discarded. The panzer divisions, most notably the Hitlerjugend, were thrown piecemeal into the inferno and were occupied with defending a large frontage. Their battle groups, their Kampfgruppen, were not deployed en masse on a short frontage where the possibility might exist that they could break through to the beaches and Allied rear areas. They were forced to attempt the Erwin Rommel-style battle right on the beaches, but were not properly deployed to do so, Allied aircraft slowing the transit times considerably. The entire destruction or severe depletion of almost all affected formations of the Normandy-Atlantic Wall forced the arriving Panzer Division into holding the line, not in any way in accordance with the prescribed German Panzerwaffe doctrine. A concentrated, coordinated thrust, so stressed in German operational thinking, had been spurned in favor of small, hasty attacks that the British Second Army responded to with determination and superior defensive firepower. Real or imagined time pressures to rapidly destroy the bridgehead, coupled with impossible travel demands due to a poorly planned deployment prior to the invasion, had led to failure. And thank you very much for coming to watch me today. And now I have time for any questions, if anybody has any.
That was really interesting. I've always been fascinated with the historiography of the Battle of Normandy, because I think most of it just repeats what other historians have written. And probably only the first five authors of books actually did research, and the rest just repeat what the others say. Now that you've wandered on the other side of the hill, because again, many historians don't even mention the enemy. They talk about specific Canadian or British or American units. What would you say to young historians coming up in terms of looking at battles and events like this and incorporating the wider picture?
First of all, technology is your friend. The amazing technology that exists in the way of computer translation software makes the now once inaccessible foreign language documents in French or German, and books as well as archival documents, very much accessible and translatable. So, you know, that amazing French book is now accessible and readable to many. It's very, very important, especially for the Normandy campaign, to consider the works of the historians of other countries. The French have a very, very balanced view of the Normandy campaign, and the military history centers in the city of Caen, as well as the city of Bayeux, are very powerful in that all these military historians for the Normandy campaign are centered there. And the just constant pumping out of books occurs, and it seems they always have the best photos and best documents, and they seem to be plugged into the veteran communities amazingly on both sides. So the French, you know, very much recognize the Second World War was often fought by other countries, but they do realize it is very much their military history. And thus these French authors, I believe they're leading the way in many respects. Hopefully that answers. Yeah.
A lot of the literature has information suggesting that the Germans had advantages with their 88s artillery and with their panzers in terms of dealing with our tanks, the Allies' tanks, and that they had these major advantages. How were these overcome, or is that too much inflated, the idea that they had these kind of advantages with their artillery and their...
These advantages were very much absolutely true. Now, how they overcome them, it led to these massive attacks on the eastern side of the bridgehead by the British Second Army that often advanced only a small number of miles or kilometers. And we see a British tactical doctrine that is very much artillery based, and when it comes to armored support, the infantry would go first and the tanks would be held back in almost in ambush positions waiting for German armor or a position that would expose itself, and then those tanks, the Allied tanks, would try to engage that target the best they could. But there's two significant disasters, one with the Sherbrooke Fusilier Regiment and second with the 1st Hussars from London, Ontario. Both attack very much tank first, and And during these battles, extremely heavy casualties in the way of tank losses occur. And this influences Canadian tank tactics for the rest of the Normandy campaign, arguably, to a certain extent. There's also the very big British attack, Operation Goodwood, which attacks with three armored divisions, and the British suffer horrendous losses at the hands of those 88-millimeter guns, as well as the German Tiger and Panther tanks, which operate using their guns to their maximum range. So the answer to this was often massive firepower, strategic heavy four-engine bombers that were bombing Germany most of the time, now rerouted to literally blast a hole in the front lines for the Allied soldiers and, you know, armored divisions and infantry divisions to surge through. But it's very, very difficult, and this led to a lack of progress, and the Americans often thought less of the British Army for this. But the fact was, the British Second Army and later the First Canadian Army were engaging the majority of the German panzer divisions, the cream of the German army, actually, in that period of time in 1944, that was not facing the United States First Army.
A little bit to piggyback off the previous question. How do you find those documents? Are they readily? Well, actually, maybe more broadly, what's your research? How does it? How do you achieve that the information that you get?
The Czech military archives run by the Czech military. They will sell you reproductions, but the amount of paperwork you have to go through is very, very difficult. And the documents themselves, they're perfect, but often these reports and the official war diaries only tell half the story. And some difficult German, you know, if a town was lost or they're forced out of it, they will say they've withdrawn, or extremely heavy losses were inflicted on the Allies or British units or Canadian units before a withdrawal took place. Often this would not be the exact truth, but spun. And of course, this is the ugly truth about all war diaries for all armies involved in the Second World War. Often what was written down is often slightly different from reality. So looking at several different sources for that one event, and this is why I study just a limited amount of times within my books. This allows me to gain the closest that I can to the real truth. And often an ugly conclusion has to be drawn that isn't what, you know, perhaps someone interested in the Canadian Army wants to hear, or, you know, very interested in the German Army. Sometimes levels of incompetence result in many people being killed and the wrong decision being made, and that certain fault is exploited by the enemy, who goes on to a tactical victory. And, you know, the truth slowly comes out the more documents and more secondary sources you look through. Yes.
Maybe I'll come to this question. So, how did you stumble upon it?
Oh,
what's the magic bean there?
The magic bean is an author called Douglas Nash, who wrote many books on the Eastern Front. And he prominently in one of his introductions is, and his bibliography, which is very, very important as all historians look to see what sources are consulted by other historians. These reproductions that had been ordered from the Czech military archives were very prominently listed there, and I made short work of, you know, trying to contact them, and they very nicely wrote back after a short period of time, you know, with all these forms that I had to fill out, of course. And, you know, if you say, well, I have infinite amounts of money, I'd like to buy everything, they say, no, you can't have everything, because they realize very quickly that if everybody has everything they ever own on the internet, then no one will actually come and contact them or use the archives anymore. There's certain laws that, you know, they can sell, like, you know, 70% or something like that. It's quite strange when I ran into this. But they did certainly help me out, as well as several gentlemen within France and within Germany, who gave me massive Microsoft OneDrive file transfers that, you know, he had a huge amount of material, almost too much. So often you have to push through it to see which is relevant, which is important, and you only have a limited amount of time if you're teaching full-time at RMC and then running home to jump onto the computer for a couple of hours before Netflix times arrives.
Did you have much access to first-hand accounts from the Hitler-Jungen division?
Yes.
During the written during or after the
yes.
battle?
The Kriegsdeutsch book
the war diaries, mm-hmm. have the Anlagen, the annex, which more lengthy reports and first-hand accounts are listed by the company, usually written by the company commanders or a platoon commander if the company commander was killed, the Zugführer, or platoon commander, mm-hmm. and they would give a more detailed account of who did what, who was killed where. This particular Untersturmführer was climbing out of his tank when he's killed by artillery shrapnel fire. As you know, and this happened then, and we did this at this particular time, and the Germans or the Canadians or British infantry was here at this particular time. So all this detail, all this detail comes out in a huge amount. And at the end of the war, the units that had these Kriegsdagbuch often destroyed them in May 1945. They're the frontline combat units of the combat divisions, but the ones that were within these Czech archives did survive up until roughly about December 1944 in some cases, usually September 1944 to December 1944. That's the cutoff administratively. But yes, hopefully.
Arthur, thanks for the presentation. It was really interesting. I'm just curious, given that 12th SS had to fight, as you laid it out, not as they wanted to fight, but as like in a series of isolated or disconnected sort of combat or battle group sort of operations, do you see that as a vindication of the Allied operational plan? In other words, were they forced to fight that way because the Allies had the initiative?
Yes. And while the Canadians moved very quickly to assume fortress positions, the British on the more western side, on the 30th Corps, had an abundance of tank units and infantry units and attacked relentlessly to force the Germans to assume a defensive stance on one side, and they could not mass their forces on a short, very small frontage where they could have potentially launched another assault. And the British, even fearing this assault, in the days that followed, built up a strength of nearly 300 and 350 tanks of the British 4th Armored Brigade that were sitting immediately behind the Canadians, and not many Canadian military history books list this, ready to fight this massive battle. And at the same time as those 350 tanks were gathered there, the Germans used all their tanks and switched them away from these 350 tanks over onto the left side where the British 30th Corps was pushing south, where the Panzer Lehr Division had not arrived and was very late in arriving, and the British were exploiting that. So it was a tremendously difficult situation for the Hitlerjugend, and it's very, very lucky that the British 4th Armored Brigade or attached forces did not attack, because all the ground lost by the German counterattack on the 7th of June would have been probably easily reclaimed. And that is not listed and you know, discussed as a topic within many Canadian histories of the Normandy campaign, that there's this massive beast of a British armored formation ready to fight a do-or-die tank battle to fight off the Germans should they launch another armored push. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. So it's so not, yes?
You mentioned that the shortfalls in the SS division were made up by bringing in army personnel.
Yes.
How well did that go?
Like some cases very poorly, but most cases, many of them had a Hitler Youth background, or you know, just like all German youth, it was compulsory to join the Hitler Youth, and they zipped right in. But they did continue to wear their army uniforms and had the army ranks, but were transferred into company commander positions in the Panzer Grenadier units or armored divisions or armored companies. One of the most disastrous tank attacks near Norrie is led by the 3rd Company of SS Panzer Regiment 12 and an army captain, Ludemann, who drives his tanks towards Norrie, and they're hit in the flank by Canadian anti-tank and tank fire, and 6 Panther tanks are knocked out almost simultaneously, and they have to immediately, quickly, very quickly retreat. He has a mental breakdown after this, Ludemann, but he's one of the prominent figures, as well as when many of the Canadian prisoners of war are being killed. There are these Heer transfers, Das Heer, the German army, transfers present on the scene, which is something somewhat ignored in the Howard Margolian account, Conduct Unbecoming, which is an excellent summary of the war crimes of the 12th SS Panzer Division. Oh,
Aiden, thank you for the presentation. So seeing that we're dealing with Hitlerjugend, people that are like highly indoctrinated into the Nazi regime, through the, your documents, do you ever see the use of the German honor system either to award these behaviors or even motivation by the lower enlisted to commit these acts in order to achieve something like an Iron Cross or something like that?
Nothing is written down. That is, you know, something that could never, you know, be incriminating. But the lack of control and the actions of many of the troops at the lowest levels of the Panzer Grenadier companies, it seems like there was absolutely no control. There was no consequences to any of their actions. Imagine living in a world or operating where you can literally do what you want, both to the French civilians, any prisoners of war you find, or to the enemy on the battlefield. Of course, you know, fighting in a conventional war, you know, observing the laws of warfare on, you know, against an enemy that's shooting back is one thing. But the freedom, you know, until they were, you know, dragged back or, you know, by their company commanders is, you know, it's amazing when you look at it. And it occurs, you know, in its intensity in the first 5 days, and then somewhat it drops off. I don't know why, because a lot of Canadian prisoners are not taken after the 11th and 12th of June. And suddenly the Hitlerjugend soldiers become more experienced. They realize if this continues, you know, I'm speculating here that, you know, of course the Canadians will do exactly what they're been doing to them to do to them. So it's a difficult topic. There is the famous story of the Panzerlehr Artillery Group, of the leadership of the Panzerlehr Artillery Regiment. They drive on the top of this hill and they think no British troops are around. And all of a sudden, several British armored cars arrive and they're all taken prisoner. And the British determine that they have to withdraw, and they're ordered by radio to return. And they take prisoner the highest ranking officer, and they can only take so many prisoners back with them due to the lack of room within these armored cars. And something terrible occurs next. The British armored car crews, they machine gun the rest of them. And the one officer, they beat him unconscious and they strap him to the front of the armored car and they drive back, and the German anti-tank gun destroys that armored car and they're all killed. But that one officer of the pile that were machine gunned, he crawls out from underneath the bodies and he crawls into the battalion headquarters of SS Panzer Grenadier Regiment 26, and he's hysterical and he's badly wounded. And he says, "The English kill the prisoners. The English kill the prisoners." And of course, how exactly this affects the Waffen-SS, of course, is not written down. But it obviously was certainly affected some of the behavior that occurred over the next few days. And there's during some of the battles on the 11th and 12th of June, one British tank crew is captured on the western flank and they're marched back. There's, out of the five crewmen, only four are alive. And due to a couple of them, you know, not walking fast enough, the German that's in charge of them and hustling them back from the Recce battalion, the Aufklärung Abteilung, he shoots two of them very casually. And of course the other two, they walk a bit faster and they're dragged back to this fighting position beside a Panther tank. And some of the wounded Germans, you know, are in blood coming down their arms. They're screaming, "Are they Canadians? Kill them! Are they Canadians? Kill them!" And then, you know, of course, they're screaming back, "We're British." And so the one half of the group of Germans is screaming, "Are they Canadians?" The other half is screaming, "Kill them." But luckily, these two survivors managed to survive. But it's a very brutal, brutal scene that shows the brutality that can occur on both sides in the immediate aftermath of combat when they've seen some of their friends being killed. And to kill without consequence, that ability is very much there. So it's the ugly, extremely ugly side of warfare.
Did any German tanks make it to any of the eastern beaches at all at any point in those first 5 or 6 days?
Yes, the reinforcements arrived to fight the Americans, and the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, Götz von Berlichten, is arrives with its self-propelled guns, which are not real tanks, right. But they do immediately begin to fight the U.S. paratroopers there.
Okay.
And they're later joined by the very powerful SS Panzer Division Das Reich, which is committed on its way to Normandy, a terrible war crime at Oder-sur-Glane, where the entire town is rounded up and shot and herded into barns and burnt to death. And
I remember that.
Yes, and then they arrive. Hmm. And it's so that there's that very famous book, The March of the Das Reich, by, I forget the author.
It was on the, on
American, the western side, yes.
Okay.
But the proper tank country, the beautiful tank country for operating with these Panther and Tiger tanks is the eastern side. And that's where the Germans thought the massive British assault or offensive would take place. A second battle of El Alamein, one the Germans were determined to fight and win defensively. And thus, the best German panzer divisions, both from Das Heer and the Waffen-SS, were located there and did not fight the Americans, arguably allowing for the American breakout and the ultimate victory during the Normandy campaign. Any further questions or anything else? Well, I'm Arthur Glaxon from the RMC History Department. It is very much my pleasure to give this presentation tonight.
Excellent. Thank you.
And you just heard from an October 17th lunch event at Novel Idea, Arthur W. Glaxon launching his latest book, The Defeat and Attrition of the 12th SS Panzer Division, Hitlerjugend, Volume 1, The Normandy Bridgehead Battles. It is 51 minutes after 5 o'clock. Let's do this, and I'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Joseph Guido. I am CFRC's Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence Project Intern. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFRC's annual funding drive is running until December 31st, and your gift is needed to help us provide local musicians with modern, top-of-the-line equipment, space, and technical support to better showcase their creativity on our airwaves all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make your gift today via cfrc.ca.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Hello, CFRC listeners. This is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca.
And you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC. As you can tell, we are in our funding drive, our 2024 funding drive this year. $25,000 is what we're hoping to get. And it started November 1st. We'll run until December 31st. One thing I'd just like to do is thank those of you who have already contributed to this program for supporting my volunteer work and also CFRC's effort to help raise money for new and upgraded studio recording equipment. We're getting there with your help. So you too can join our supporters by donating now. I encourage you to go to our website, www.cfrc.ca, click on the donate button, and it shows how you can either give through to Queens on one side of it and get a tax receipt, or donate directly to us, qualify for prizes and raffles. So from sponsors who are helping us out with this year. My heartfelt thanks to all of you out there for listening today. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. Both hours of the show are uploaded to my blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. We'll remain there for 3 years. They usually get that done about 7 o'clock. I hope you can stay tuned for 3 hours of East Coast, or 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music that's hosted by Rob Carnell. Coming right up at the top of the hour, right after I'm going to play a song to take us there. Again, thank you all for tuning in. Thanks to the authors who took part in today's show. Here's Joni Mitchell with Cactus Tree.
There's a man who's been out sailing in a decade full of dreams, and he takes her to a schooner, and he treats her like a queen. Mary beads from California with her amber stones and green. He has called her from the harbor, he has kissed her with his freedom, he has heard her off starboard in the breaking and the breathing of the water weeds, while she was busy being free. There's a man who's climbed a mountain and he's calling out her name, and he hopes her heart can hear. 3,000 miles he calls again. There beside him, he can miss her just the same. He has missed her in the forest, while he showed her all the flowers, and the branches sang the chorus as he climbed the scaly towers of a forest tree, while she somewhere being free. There's a man who sent a letter and he's waiting for reply. He has asked her of her travels since the day they said goodbye. He writes, wish you were beside me, we can make it if we try. He has seen her at the office with her name on all his papers. Through the sharing of the profits, he will find it hard to shake her from his memory. And she's so busy being free. There's a lady in the city and she thinks she loves them all. There's the one thinking of her, there's the one who sometimes calls, there's the one who writes her letters with his facts and figures scrawled. She has brought them to her senses, they have laughed inside her laughter. Now she rallies her defenses, for she fears that one will ask her for eternity. There's a man who sends her medals, he's bleeding from the war. There's a jouster and a jester and a man who owns a store. There's a drummer and a dreamer, and you know there may be more. She will love them when she sees them, they will lose her if they follow, and she only means to them. And her heart is full and hollow like a cactus tree, while she's so busy being free. Like a cactus tree. free.